Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Michael Roy with highlights for February 2012. Leading off this month will be our treatment and psychiatry article about abnormal thyroid function tests in psychiatric patients. We'll then discuss our review article on persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn and its relation to serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Our original research articles include a study that focused on the relationship of childhood maltreatment to both the course of depression and to treatment outcome. Another study examined the response of the striatum to both negative and positive stimuli in depressed patients. We'll also feature research on medications for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. One study tracked the change over a 12-year period in the use of stimulants among children, and two other studies examined cardiovascular effects of stimulants in children and in adults. We'll begin with our treatment and psychiatry article, Abnormal Thyroid Function Tests in Psychiatric Patients. Thyroid disturbances can have a variety of neuropsychiatric symptoms, but not all abnormalities on thyroid tests in psychiatric patients signify true thyroid disease. Altered thyroid function parameters can occur as a response to underlying systemic disease or acute psychiatric illness. Anna Dickerman and John Barnhill discuss abnormal thyroid function test results and whether they're generally a red herring. They present the example of a young woman with bipolar 1 disorder. She'd recently been non-adherent to her medication regimen of valproic acid and risperidone. Her mother brought her to the emergency department because of depressive symptoms, irritability, somatic preoccupation, and delusions of persecution. The patient's free T4 level was elevated, but there were no findings on physical examination that suggested hyperthyroidism. She was admitted to the inpatient psychiatric unit, and the treatment team obtained an endocrinology consultation. The clinical findings and laboratory results suggested that the patient was euthyroid. Over the next week, she was restarted on valproic acid and risperidone, and she returned to her baseline level of psychiatric functioning. 1 month later, her thyroid function test results were in the normal range. The patterns of abnormal thyroid function test findings in patients with acute psychiatric illness vary among diagnoses. Patients with acute psychiatric disorders may exhibit a high level of total or free T4 in the absence of hyperthyroidism. This is referred to as euthyroid hyperthyroxenemia. In a large study of psychiatric inpatients, this was significantly more common in patients with mood disorders, while elevated TSH levels were highest in patients with substance use disorders. In patients with depression, T4 levels may increase as a result of decreased peripheral conversion of T4 to T3. Certain medications prescribed by psychiatrists may also cause changes in thyroid function tests that may not necessarily indicate actual thyroid illness. However, lithium and carbamazepine can cause true alterations of thyroid function. Lithium is well known to induce true hypothyroidism. Carbamazepine induces metabolism of thyroid hormones by the liver. Therefore, patients who are on exogenous thyroid hormone replacement may become hypothyroid when treated with carbamazepine, and they may therefore require higher hormone replacement doses. Unless there's clinical evidence of thyroid disease, routine screening with thyroid function testing isn't generally helpful. In the psychiatric population, only a minority of abnormal thyroid lab test results are clinically significant. Patients who should be considered at greater risk of having actual primary thyroid disease are those with a history of neck surgery or radiation, autoimmune disorder, or lithium use, or those with a family history of thyroid disease. Women in general are more likely than men to suffer from true thyroid dysfunction, and the elderly are at greater risk than younger patients. Nevertheless, it's helpful to remember that most patients with non-thyroidal illness don't have the typical constellation of symptoms seen in thyroid deficiency or excess. Thyroid function tests should generally be deferred in hospitalized medical patients who don't have clinical features suggesting pituitary or thyroid disease, at least until recovery from the acute illness. However, there should be a lower threshold for screening in the geriatric population, since these patients may have true thyroid disease without typical signs or symptoms. Decisions regarding thyroid screening can be made on a case-by-case basis using sound clinical logic. If there's strong clinical suspicion for true thyroidal illness, TSH should be measured with a sensitive third-generation assay. Endocrinologists have recommended that in these cases, free T4 should be measured along with TSH, and any abnormal free T4 values should be confirmed by a dialysis method. On the other hand, TRH stimulation, serum T3, and reverse T3 are usually considered unhelpful in such patients. When secondary hypothyroidism is suspected, evaluation of pituitary function is recommended. In cases of suspected primary hypothyroidism or Graves' disease, measurements of antithyroid antibodies may also be helpful, although it should be remembered that lithium may induce production of these antibodies in certain cases. The pattern of thyroid function abnormalities observed in test results can help distinguish non-thyroidal disorders from true thyroidal illness. Thyroid or pituitary disease leads to predictable, concordant relationships between TSH and free T4 because of feedback mechanisms. Alterations of these parameters in non-thyroidal illness are typically discordant and non-diagnostic. In true hyperthyroidism, TSH, measured by a third-generation assay, is typically undetectable, but fewer than 1% of patients with non-thyroidal illness have undetectable levels. Hypothyroidism may also be a challenging diagnosis to make, as up to 12% of patients with non-thyroidal illness may have elevated TSH values. However, fewer than 3% of these patients have TSH levels above 20 microunits per milliliter. Levels greater than 25 or 30 strongly suggest primary hypothyroidism, particularly when coupled with suppressed T4 and T3 levels. A low level of free T4, in the absence of drugs known to suppress TSH, also suggests hypothyroidism. In psychiatry, there are specific cases where fully euthyroid patients may benefit from thyroid hormone replacement with T3. For example, female patients in particular may experience augmentation and acceleration of response to antidepressant treatment, and rapid cycling bipolar patients may have a reduction in the frequency of cycling with thyroid hormone supplementation. In the case of an elevated TSH level with equivocal results for free T4, subclinical hypothyroidism may be present. This is distinct from non-thyroidal illness, and there's an extensive literature on this condition in the psychiatric population. In a psychiatric patient with high TSH and low to normal free T4, it may be difficult to distinguish between non-thyroidal illness and subclinical hypothyroidism. If such a patient has other signs or symptoms of true thyroid disease, few would argue against thyroid replacement therapy. However, if there's no evidence of thyroidal illness and the patient has recently been medically hospitalized or is in the midst of an acute psychiatric episode, it may be prudent to defer hormone replacement. When the patient has stabilized, thyroid function tests can be repeated. Proceeding to our review article, we shift from thyroid to pulmonary functioning. Specifically, persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn in relation to selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Recent studies have indicated that there's an association, and clinicians and patients are now more reluctant to use SSRIs during pregnancy. However, additional clinical studies have identified maternal depression, rather than SSRI exposure, as a risk factor for pulmonary hypertension in newborns. Malioki Ogroso and colleagues point out that persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn is rare. It affects just under 2 infants per 1,000 live births. Numerous risk factors have been identified, and some of these, such as substance abuse, premature birth, and cesarean section, are more common in women with depression. Pulmonary hypertension in newborns is a heterogeneous condition with multiple etiologies. 40% of the cases occur because of aspiration of meconium. SSRIs are known to cause gastrointestinal hypermotility in adults and newborns, but a potential association with meconium aspiration hasn't been examined. Although mortality associated with pulmonary hypertension in newborns is 10 to 20%, the rates vary according to etiology. Mortality is relatively low, 6%, in cases related to meconium aspiration. In follow-up studies of infants exposed to SSRIs who had persistent pulmonary hypertension, no deaths have been reported. The physiology of pulmonary hypertension in newborns includes multiple interacting mechanisms, including vascular development and smooth muscle functioning. Genetic studies have identified 2 functional polymorphisms in the serotonin transporter gene that may modulate the risk for developing pulmonary hypertension. Both of them regulate the same calcium-binding protein, which induces migration and proliferation of smooth muscle cells in pulmonary arteries. Serotonin is a potent pulmonary vasoconstrictor, and in adults, pulmonary hypertension is associated with alterations in serotonin signaling and metabolism. The lung doesn't have any prominent serotonergic innervation, but serotonin is produced in vascular endothelium, and the serotonin transporter is expressed in vascular smooth muscle. This muscle takes up serotonin in vesicles and releases it in response to local stimuli. There's very little free serotonin in the bloodstream because it's rapidly metabolized. Most of the blood content of serotonin is stored in platelets. SSRIs block the uptake of serotonin into platelets, so whole blood serotonin levels are low during exposure to SSRIs. Tryptophan hydroxylase is an enzyme that limits the rate of serotonin production in the endothelial cells of pulmonary vasculature. Adults with idiopathic pulmonary hypertension have increased production of tryptophan hydroxylase in the pulmonary vascular endothelium. Some medical conditions that impair platelet storage of serotonin are associated with greater circulating serotonin levels and a higher risk of adult pulmonary hypertension. In addition, there's a strain of rats with an inherited dysfunction of platelet serotonin storage, and these rats have elevated serum serotonin levels and develop pulmonary hypertension. In adult animal models, SSRIs have a protective effect against the development of pulmonary hypertension. A cross-sectional clinical study suggested that SSRIs may slow the progression of pulmonary hypertension in adults, but a longitudinal study did not show any benefit. SSRIs aren't currently recommended for pulmonary hypertension in adults, but they aren't contraindicated either. It's difficult to study the relationship between SSRIs and pulmonary hypertension in infants because the condition is so rare. The existing clinical literature consists of 6 studies. They identified a total of 50 infants with pulmonary hypertension among 25,000 who were exposed to SSRIs. 2 of the studies examined the same database, with additional births included in the second study. They both found overall relative risk of about 3.5. A third study found an increased risk only if the SSRI exposure occurred in the second half of pregnancy. The other 3 studies found no increased risk. While persistent pulmonary hypertension is rare in infants, about a quarter of those exposed to SSRIs in utero will experience a transient neonatal adaptation syndrome. This is a mix of symptoms consistent with either SSRI withdrawal or toxicity, including jitteriness, gastrointestinal distress, feeding difficulties, and poor temperature regulation. It also includes tachypnea and other symptoms of respiratory distress, and these may appear earlier than the gastrointestinal and irritability symptoms. At this point, the data supporting a link between SSRI exposure and pulmonary hypertension are weak. Many factors associated with depression itself may account for the association, and there's been no examination of the possible relationship. Also, it's important to balance the risk of pulmonary hypertension in the infant against the risk of untreated depression in the mother. Women who stop taking their antidepressants in the peripartum period have a nearly 70% chance of a major depressive episode, compared with about a quarter of those who stay on their medication. Now we'll take a look at a risk factor for depression itself, childhood maltreatment. Valentina Nanni and colleagues examined this relationship more specifically in a meta-analysis of whether childhood maltreatment predicts unfavorable course of illness and treatment outcome in depression. The analysis included both epidemiological and clinical studies of childhood maltreatment, which was defined as physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, or family conflict or violence. Depression recurrence was measured as the number of depressive episodes over a given period, or as the risk of a new depressive episode in individuals with a prior history of depression. Depression persistence was defined as a prolonged duration of uninterrupted illness, including dysthymia. Treatment outcome was defined as the change in depression between the beginning and end of treatment, either as the percentage improvement on a depression rating scale, or as a categorical outcome of response or remission. The data extracted from the literature search were converted to odds ratio effect sizes. These reflected the probability of an unfavorable outcome, with an odds ratio above 1, reflecting a greater likelihood of recurrence, persistence, or poor treatment outcome in individuals with a history of childhood maltreatment. The first analysis focused on the association with either recurrence or persistence of depressive disorder. The literature review found 16 relevant studies, with more than 20,000 participants. The epidemiological studies suggested that individuals with a history of childhood maltreatment were twice as likely as others to develop recurrent or persistent depressive episodes. Findings from clinical trials were consistent with these observations. The analysis of treatment outcome classified the treatments as psychological therapy, antidepressant medication, or combined treatment. 10 clinical trials were included, with more than 3,000 participants. Overall, the depressed individuals with a history of childhood maltreatment were significantly less likely to benefit from treatment compared with other depressed patients. Sensitivity analyses were used to distinguish among the different types of treatment. For psychotherapy, the effect of childhood maltreatment on outcome fell just short of significance. The effect was significant for medication, and patients with childhood maltreatment were nearly twice as likely to have a worse outcome with combined treatment compared with other depressed patients. The authors examined several possible sources of artifact or bias. They found no significant effects from publication bias, study quality, or recall bias. In addition, in the epidemiological studies, the effect of childhood maltreatment appeared to be present in both clinical and population samples, and it wasn't influenced by the age at onset of the depression. Another possible confounder is the specific type of childhood maltreatment, but the available data didn't allow analysis of this variable. In clinical care, information about a history of childhood maltreatment could help identify individuals who are at high risk of developing a recurrent and progressive subtype of depression, and those who will respond poorly to treatment. Clinicians may also consider more intensive and alternative treatment options for depressed individuals with a history of childhood maltreatment. The evidence from this meta-analysis indicates that simply combining psychotherapy and medication isn't sufficient. It may be useful for future studies to explore the cognitive and biological correlates of childhood maltreatment. It's already been established that depression is associated with attenuated striatal functioning and with affective bias. Depressed individuals have an enhanced sensitivity to negative stimuli and show behavioral neglect of positive stimuli. The experimental model that's most often used to examine this negative bias in flexible learning is the probabilistic reversal learning paradigm. Subjects learn by trial and error to choose the most rewarding stimulus. Then they reverse their choice when the contingencies change and the previously rewarding stimulus is unexpectedly followed by punishment. In this probabilistic task, around one-fourth of the reward and punishment feedback is misleading. Depressed individuals reverse their choice more often than healthy individuals when they receive misleading negative feedback. Oliver Robinson and colleagues sought to learn more about these cognitive processes in depression, and so they tested ventral striatum response during both reward and punishment reversal learning in unmedicated major depressive disorder. They used a deterministic task rather than a probabilistic one. The subjects didn't directly choose the rewarded or punished stimulus. Instead, they predicted the outcome of stimuli selected by the computer. They were required to reverse their behavior as soon as they received unexpected outcomes. The study design involved Pavlovian rather than instrumental conditioning, and this allowed assessment of reversals on the basis of unexpected reward as well as unexpected punishment. The task was used previously to show that punishment and reward reversals rely on overlapping but distinct regions of the striatum. The participants in the study were 13 patients diagnosed with major depressive disorder and 14 healthy comparison subjects. The groups were matched on age, gender, education, and IQ. They performed the behavioral task during brain imaging with functional MRI. Brain activity was analyzed in the left and right caudate and putamen. A whole brain voxel-wise analysis was also conducted to investigate the extended functional anatomical network of regions that may interact with the striatum during task performance. The exercise involved presentation of two vertically adjacent stimuli, one seen and one face. One of them was associated with reward and the other with punishment. The participants were required to learn these deterministic associations between stimulus and outcome by trial and error. In standard reversal paradigms, the subjects are required to choose between the two stimuli. In this design, however, they were instructed to predict whether the stimulus highlighted by a black border would lead to reward or to punishment. The task contingencies were thus Pavlovian and expected to be processed more specifically in the ventral striatum. In the reversal trials, when the contingencies changed, the depressed patients and healthy subjects had comparable reaction times during both reward and punishment reversals. However, the depressed participants made more errors than the comparison subjects on trials involving reward reversal, whereas they had equal numbers of errors for punishment reversals. There were also no differences between groups in the trials without reversals. The most striking pattern of neural effects was in the right putamen, and so the data from this region were emphasized in the analyses. A significantly decreased response in the right putamen was observed in depressed individuals during reward reversals, but not punishment reversals, and not during non-reversal trials. These results correspond with the patterns for accuracy. Within the depressed group, scores on the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale did not correlate with the ventral putamen response to unexpected reward or with the error rate in reward reversal trials. The locus within the striatum that showed an attenuated response to unexpected rewards implicated a region of the anterior ventrolateral putamen. This area receives projections from both the medial and orbital prefrontal cortical networks and from the amygdala. So the attenuated response in the putamen may have been driven by abnormal afferent transmission from these cortical regions, rather than by a specific abnormality in the striatum. The findings thus provide a neural target for recovery from major depressive disorder. They also suggest a clinical target to improve the ability of depressed patients to learn about rewarding feedback, including social interactions and positive life experiences. This study, and the one on childhood maltreatment, at first seemed to anchor opposite ends of the depression research spectrum. In his editorial, Gregory Simon points out that they converge when it comes to the interaction of experience with our interpretation of experience in the genesis and maintenance of depression. In the study by Nanny and colleagues, a recalled history of childhood maltreatment was associated with the outcome of depression. But what's the direction of causality? One view focuses on the effect of experience, concluding that childhood maltreatment increases the long-term risk of depression. An alternative view focuses on the interpretation of experience, concluding that more severe or recurrent depression increases the likelihood that traumatic childhood experiences will be recalled. The meta-analysis didn't distinguish these two possibilities. Other research designs, however, help clarify the direction of causality. In support of the hypothesis that childhood maltreatment causes subsequent depression, two prospective studies demonstrated an association between documented maltreatment and subsequent depression. Two twin studies indicated that childhood maltreatment has a specific effect on the risk of adult depression beyond any genetic or shared familial effects. However, there's also evidence that childhood maltreatment is not often reported, and that recall is influenced by mood state. This suggests a recursive relationship. Childhood maltreatment increases the risk for adult depression, which may then increase the likelihood that childhood maltreatment will be recalled. In more general terms, negative experience increases the risk of depression, but depression can also increase the recall of negative experience. This ties into the experimental research by Robinson and colleagues, who found an effect of mood on the interpretation of negative and positive events. The two studies have implications for the treatment of depression. The association between childhood maltreatment and poorer prognosis of depression does not necessarily imply that treatment for depression is less valuable or necessary. Whether or not a history of childhood trauma argues for or against the benefit of depression treatment can only be answered with data comparing treatment with no treatment. This distinction is most clearly illustrated by research on the severity of depression and the outcome of antidepressant treatment. More severe depression predicts poorer treatment outcome. However, pre-treatment severity also predicts greater effectiveness of antidepressant treatment when compared with placebo. There's no conflict between these two findings. An individual characteristic can predict poor outcome with treatment and even poorer outcome without treatment. Currently, it's unclear whether a history of childhood maltreatment should affect the selection of a specific depression therapy. In one study of outpatients with chronic depression, a history of childhood trauma predicted more favorable response to a cognitive behavioral type of psychotherapy than to nifazodone. But this finding hasn't been replicated, and it's not known whether it might generalize to other medications or to other types of psychotherapy. The findings of Robinson and colleagues about the response to reward raise interesting questions about the aims and content of psychotherapy for depression. Established psychotherapies for depression typically include a mix of interventions to reduce the depressogenic impact of negative experiences and augment the antidepressant effect of positive experiences. If the cognitive biases of depression reside more in a diminished response to a positive experience and less in an exaggerated response to a negative experience, this might have implications for developing more narrowly targeted psychotherapy. In a previous clinical study of severe depression, behavioral activation focusing on increased exposure to positive events was more effective than cognitive therapy. When considering the clinical implications of these two lines of research, it's important to remember that greater clarity about the etiology or pathophysiology of depression may not directly translate into more effective or more specific therapy. The etiological role of childhood trauma might suggest that the most effective psychotherapy would focus on reducing the enduring effects of the traumatic experience. But the findings on the response to reward in depression might suggest the opposite approach, focusing instead on increasing exposure to positive experiences. Etiology or pathophysiology cannot settle questions of therapy, but they can suggest specific hypotheses to guide the development and testing of theoretically informed treatments. In our final three articles, we'll be looking at the pharmacological treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The first study estimated current rates of stimulant use by children in the U.S. The rate increased steeply during the 1990s, and by 1997, more than 2.5% of U.S. children were taking stimulants. In the past decade, a number of new formulations of methylphenidate and amphetamines have been introduced into clinical practice, including controlled-release oral and transdermal preparations. Samuel Zavikas and Benedetto Vidiello have now updated the numbers on prevalence. They analyzed data for the years 1996 to 2008. The analysis was based on the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. This is the nationally representative household survey of healthcare use and costs conducted by the U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. The analytic sample included all individuals age 18 and younger in each year. The number of households sampled each year varied, but was between 6 and 12,000. Data on prescription drug use were collected in two ways, directly from the households and from a follow-back survey of all pharmacies reported by the household. A signed permission form was obtained in order to seek pharmacy information. Stimulants were defined as methylphenidate, dexmethylphenidate, pemoline, amphetamines, and dextroamphetamine. The rate of stimulant use in this survey increased from 2.4% in 1996 to 3.5% in 2008. The growth was statistically significant, but the rate of change was substantially slower than the growth rate during the preceding decade. Stimulant use remained highest in 6 to 12-year-olds, but it grew so much in adolescence that they nearly caught up to the younger group. The rate of use by preschoolers remained low. More than three times as many boys as girls used stimulants in 2008. Stimulant use in children from racial and ethnic minority groups increased, although the rate remained lower than in non-Hispanic white children. Significant differences were also found across regions of the U.S. Rates of utilization increased substantially in the Northeast, whereas the West maintained a consistently lower rate. Questions have been raised about the cardiovascular effects of stimulants. Methylphenidate and amphetamines increase noradrenergic and dopaminergic transmission and exhibit sympathomimetic activity that's associated with cardiovascular effects. Previous studies have shown increases in heart rate and blood pressure in both children and adults, but have covered relatively short time periods. Benedetto Vidiello and colleagues gathered data on blood pressure and heart rate from a 10-year treatment study of children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The study included children 7 to 9 years old with a DSM-IV diagnosis of the combined type of ADHD. They were randomly assigned to 14 months of treatment with stimulant medication, behavioral therapy, both treatments, or usual community treatment. All of the children were medically healthy and had no evidence of cardiovascular disease. After the controlled trial, all of the children received naturalistic community treatment and were assessed every 2 or 3 years. The last evaluation was 10 years after randomization. The treatments differed in their effects on ADHD symptoms at the end of the controlled study and up to 10 months afterward, but not at the subsequent visits. Nearly 300 children were randomly assigned to receive medication, either alone or in combination with behavioral therapy. Some of the children assigned to usual community treatment also received stimulants. Some children in the behavioral therapy group also reported treatment with stimulants through their private pediatricians. At year 6, the number of children taking stimulants had fallen to 170, and at year 10, it was only 18. Data on blood pressure and heart rate, however, were available for at least 60% of the study patients at each assessment. Blood pressure was examined both as absolute values and as a categorical measure. None of these measures indicated that stimulant treatment increased the risk for hypertension or prehypertension over the 10 years of observation. These findings were confirmed by sensitivity analyses to account for total exposure, as well as recent and current exposure. Stimulant treatment was found to increase heart rate at 3 time points. At the end of the 14-month trial, the heart rate of the children treated with stimulants was about 5 beats per minute higher than the rate of children who were assigned to behavioral therapy alone or to community treatment. Greater cumulative stimulant exposure was also associated with a higher heart rate at years 3 and 8. However, the effect at year 3 disappeared when current stimulant use was controlled for. Stimulant medication did not increase the risk for tachycardia. The clinical implication of persistent adrenergic stimulation, especially for individuals with underlying heart abnormalities, can't be determined from these data. However, a graded relationship between increasing resting heart rate and mortality is well documented in adults and is independent of systolic blood pressure. The effect of stimulants at year 8 of this study indicates that users don't develop complete tolerance to the adrenergic activity of stimulant medication. As already mentioned, stimulants have been shown to raise both heart rate and blood pressure in adults, as well as children. Heidi Schellemann and colleagues examined whether this also means that adult stimulant users have higher rates of serious cardiovascular events or death. They looked specifically at new users of methylphenidate. The records were from a Medicaid database covering several states and from a commercial insurance database. All patients age 18 and older who filled a prescription for oral methylphenidate were identified. The cohort consisted of new users who had at least 180 days of observation before the first prescription for methylphenidate. They were matched with comparison subjects who did not use methylphenidate, amphetamines, or atomoxetine. Each methylphenidate user was matched on data source, state, sex, and age category to as many as 4 non-users. More than 40,000 new users were identified and matched to non-users. At baseline, the methylphenidate users were more likely than the non-users to have pre-existing cardiovascular conditions. 4 primary outcomes were studied: sudden cardiac death or ventricular arrhythmia, stroke, myocardial infarction, or either stroke or myocardial infarction. Secondary outcomes were death from all causes and death from causes other than suicide. The observation period ended with one of these events: the end of the last prescription period, the end of the study, or disenrollment from the healthcare plan. For the new methylphenidate users, the median follow-up time was 60 days. For each outcome studied, a hazard ratio was calculated to indicate the risk of that outcome in the methylphenidate users relative to the risk for the non-users. The hazard ratios were adjusted for baseline variables by using propensity score analysis. For sudden cardiac death or ventricular arrhythmia, the adjusted hazard ratio was 1.8. The ratios for stroke, myocardial infarction, or either one were not significant. For the secondary outcome of death from all causes, the adjusted hazard ratio was 1.7, and the results for non-suicide deaths were nearly identical. The two databases were also examined separately. There was a statistically significant difference in the adjusted hazard ratios for death from all causes. The ratio for the Medicaid group was 1.3, compared with 5.5 for the group with commercial insurance. The effect of dose was also analyzed. The median methylphenidate dosage among users with cardiovascular events was 20 milligrams a day. When a high dose was defined as more than this, there was no association with the occurrence of sudden death or ventricular arrhythmia. However, there were unexpected inverse associations between a high dose and stroke, myocardial infarction, either of these events, and death from all causes. Extended-release formulations of methylphenidate weren't associated in either direction with the primary outcomes. However, they were linked to a lower risk of death from all causes. The hazard ratios for all outcomes were numerically higher during the initial 180 days of methylphenidate treatment than during the next 180 days. The hazard ratios didn't differ by age or cardiovascular condition, but the adjusted hazard ratio for myocardial infarction was lower in men than in women. Schellemann and colleagues question whether the association between the start of methylphenidate treatment and the higher rate of sudden cardiac death or ventricular arrhythmia represents a true causal effect. The inverse relationship between dose and this outcome doesn't support a causal relationship. Furthermore, the inverse relationships between dose and the rates of stroke, myocardial infarction, their composite, and death from all causes may suggest that lower dosages were prescribed to the frailest patients. This concludes our audio highlights of the February issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.com. www.psychiatryonline.org for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Next month, we'll feature the effect of gastric bypass on the pharmacokinetics of serotonin reuptake inhibitors, an empirically derived taxonomy for personality diagnosis, a study of whether anticonvulsants affect the risk of suicidal behavior in bipolar disorder, a trial of fluoxetine for repetitive behaviors in adult autism spectrum disorders, and the association of cerebral emboli with accelerated cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. We hope you'll join us. Thank you.